The one of the if I had to nominate the most misused phrase of the last few years, the most misused phrase, you might think about what your nominee would be, but my nominee would be the science is settled. How many times have we heard that? You know, the you look back at history, the science was settled that the earth was the center of the universe. And then along came Galileo and Copernicus. Science wasn't settled. The science was settled that the universe has always existed. And then along came Hubble and Einstein. Science wasn't settled. Now, I'm a scientist and an engineer, and you know my background. I've got 3 degrees in structural engineering, including a PhD, which is basically the study of the science behind structural engineering. So I'm a scientist and an engineer. And so I know a lot about structures and bridges and so forth. And I give you that background because as you're driving over multiple bridges daily, and I dare say there's not a person in this room that did not cross at least one bridge today coming to church, you never give a thought that one might collapse. And then like a few years ago, that Wisconsin bridge collapsed for apparently no reason. The science is not settled, even on something that mundane. Or if you give thought to the safety of entering into a high-rise building until a condo collapses in Florida. The science of structural engineering is not settled. Things do fall down. The science is not settled. The science is rarely settled, as a matter of fact, on anything. You know, as a teacher, professor at LSU for 25 years, and almost 40 years of teaching all total, I don't just teach. I do a lot of science. I do research projects. Over the course of my time at LSU, I probably brought in somewhere around $4 million in research contracts to the university, which they love that, and because they take a big part of that. Some of it goes to pay my salary, but if they don't have to pay my salary, they just use what we would have paid me for something else. So they're really happy about stuff like that. But I've gotten grants from industry, from state government, from federal government, and I've specialized in repair and rehabilitation. And one of my focuses, and this was about a 15-year study, was in the repair of steel bridges using heat straightening. And the concept was fairly simple. Is you take blow torches and just heat here, heat there, a little line heat there, a little circle here, a little maybe a V heat there, and you can straighten damaged steel in bridges. Now, I'm an expert in that area, and I like this definition of an expert as someone who learns more and more about less and less until he knows everything about nothing. Now, this is a very small, this area of preparing damaged steel by heat straightening is a very small area, and I'm this country's leading expert in that. I've done research for 15 years. I've published dozens of papers. I've gone to about 35 different states and put on three-day workshops. I've gone on sites to repair, probably, or advised on the repair of at least 50 damaged bridges. And in fact, they look something like this one. A drunk dump truck driver got carried away after he dumped his load and forgot to put his bed down under the bridge. There went the bridge, and there went the bed of his dump truck, too. But I wrote the book. Federal Highway Administration contracted me to write the book on heat stroke. So I'm the expert, widely recognized in this country as the expert on heat stroke. That really sounds good, except for one thing. Nobody else in this country has ever looked into that problem. I'm the only person that has studied and developed this particular process. And so, you know, as a matter of fact, it's kind of ironic in talking about this, as you'll see when I get further into my sermon, I'm the great expert here, but nobody else is working in it. I'm the only expert. So that puts an entirely different light on it. But I know what I'm doing, and a bridge like this can be made to look like a bridge like that over a few days of judiciously heating the bridge in certain spots, and it works great. But as much as I know, there's some things I still don't know about heat straightening. The science is not settled, which is why I bring this up, because sometimes there are puzzling things that happen in a heat straightening project. And every time I've been involved in one, I don't do this much anymore, but I used to go out, contractors would have me come out, watch them, and explain to them, teach them basically how to do heat straightening. Or they'd call me, hey, this thing's not straightening, come and help me, and I'd do that. And I kept, every time I do that, I would learn more about heat straightening. But there's always more to learn because science is just never settled. I like what Stephen Hawkins wrote in this book on titled A Brief History of Time. He says, any physical theory is always provisional in the sense that it is only a hypothesis. You can never prove it, no matter how many times the results of experiments agree with some theory, you can never be sure that the next time the results will not contradict the theory. On the other hand, you can disprove a theory by finding even one single observation that disagrees with the predictions of the theory. Each time new experiments are observed to agree with the predictions of the theory survives. Our confidence in it is increased, but if ever a new observation is found to disagree, we have to abandon or modify the theory. Now, as a structural engineer, basically I use Newton's laws. Structural engineers, just about everything that structural engineers do, the foundation is Newton's laws. But Einstein showed that Newton's laws aren't always accurate. But they're close enough for government work. Now, on this planet, on this Earth, they work pretty well. But when we start talking about interstellar, then Newton's laws don't predict the orbits of various planets and things like that. But the science is never settled, and they still call Einstein's theory a theory. Why? Because it doesn't work at the quantum level. Quantum level, that's down where we're talking about electrons, atoms, inside of atoms, and parts of electrons, parts of neutrons, parts of protons. You get down to that level, Einstein's theory just doesn't seem to work. And he spent the latter part of his life trying to bring the two, quantum theory and relativity, together into one unified theory. Still hasn't happened yet. But the thing is, I have had to make lots of decisions as a structural engineer. Judgments, deciding how big, what to do with this type of structure, that type of structure. And I've used science. And I have to admit that the Bible has been pretty much useless in terms of designing structures. About the only thing I've found that's helpful in the Bible is the Bible does tell us that sometimes structures collapse. The walls of Jericho, the Tower of Siloam. That's about as much information as I have on structural engineering from the Bible. So what I'm getting at here is that, and I'm leading into decision making is where I'm leading into here, but the Bible doesn't help me much with making decisions related to structural engineering situations. But science does. The science does. And true science can help us in all things, but I want to begin to focus here on making decisions. And true science can help us make decisions. And the Bible can help us make those decisions. But each plays a role. True science doesn't have to conflict with the Bible. But how well can we use them together? And I want to take a look at that in some detail here. How do we as Christians use science? It's the first question I want to ask. Now, so basically the topic is the Bible, science, and judgment. Making good judgment. So how do we use science? I've put a short list here of the ways that we use science. The proper way to use science. And the first point is to recognize the limitations of science, that it is the study of the physical world and a spiritual component is simply not recognized. There is no spiritual component to science. It's all physical. So that separates science from the Bible and from God in the sense that you just don't get any spiritual aspects out of science, basically. Second point is recognize that only scientific theories, which are strongly supported by experimental evidence, are accepted by reputable science. You've got to look at the data. One of the things that's caused a lot of problems with COVID over the last 2 years is the data. Some people are looking at this data, some people are looking at that data, very few people are looking at all the data and making judgments and decisions based on everything. Politics has gotten involved. But the stronger it's supported by data, the stronger the theory is. Take Einstein's theory. There's a lot of data that supports it. One of the first ways they tested Einstein's theory was in the orbit of Mercury. Mercury had a deviation in its orbit that Newton's laws couldn't account for. They applied theory of relativity, and that accounted for that deviation. So it worked. And every time that they've been able to test the theory of relativity, it's been proven correctly. GPS, you wouldn't be able to use GPS systems without the theory of relativity, for example. I've talked about that before. But third point, don't misapply science by applying it to areas outside the limits of the theory. And a lot of people do that. How is it figures don't lie, but liars often figure? A lot of misuse of science. Number four, scientific theories with little or no evidence are speculation at best, and at worst, attempts to influence non-scientific agendas. You have to really watch that. Some interesting theories out there that really have no scientific evidence. They're just theories. The science is not settled. Number five, when the Bible is silent, use science cautiously. Be very careful when you don't have any help from the Bible. Number six, where the Bible is not silent, accept only science that's consistent with the Bible. Okay, so this is going to be at least a two-part, possibly a three-part sermon. On the general topic, what I've given the title here is If We Knew But Where. And I was feeling kind of poetic when I prepared this sermon. And so this English poet, William Cowper, had this in one of his poems. And differing judgments serve but to declare that the truth lies somewhere, if we knew but where. And so that's a good topic, a good t- title to get into, but this first part of this, to see ourselves as others see us. In other words, as I said, I'm going to be talking about decision making, making judgments. And, you know, how often do we not see ourselves as others see us? But how do you go about making good judgments? Now, when I say judgments, I'm not talking about judging other people. I'm talking about the judgment you make in your own personal life that affects your future, the decisions you make, the how do you go about making good judgments of that nature? How do you avoid making bad judgments? Now, I'm going to kind of focus on that part in this sermon. How do you avoid making bad judgments rather than how do you go about making good judgments? Let's focus on how you can avoid bad judgments. And what I want to do is I want to look at both science and the Bible and see what they tell us about how to avoid making bad judgments. Now, you think about, well, what are some of the important judgments that we make? And the kind of judgments I'm talking about. You know, like, should I marry this person? That's a pretty big judgment you have to make. Or should I go to college? Or should I quit this job and take some other job? Should I change the direction of my career? Now, I'm talking about these kind of judgments you have to make that has a big influence on your life. You know, I've made big judgments in my life, you know, changed jobs and things of this nature. All of you have too. So judgment is an important part of what we do. So let's start with the question, how good are you at making important decisions? What do you think? Just as off the top of your head, are you pretty good at decision making? Making good judgments about what you should do in this situation and that situation. I'll be poetic again. Robert Burns said this, "Oh, would some power the gift give us to see ourselves as others see us?" Now, I'll tell you, I'm talking about me being an expert. I'm an expert in structural engineering. But I'm also a pretty good expert in judging the dumb things that other people do. Aren't we all kind of experts in seeing the dumb judgments that other people make? It's pretty easy to do that. You know, sometimes you just shake your head. Man, what is wrong with that person? But it's a little bit harder when you're trying to look at yourself and make a judgment. Then it's an entirely different story. So let's start with another question here. Now, basically, isn't the Bible enough? Shouldn't that really be all that we need? Look at the scripture here. John 17, verses 14 through 18 is what we'll look at first here. It's Christ's prayer the night before he was arrested, leading to his crucifixion. And he says, "I have given them your word," and he's talking about his disciples, which in turn has passed that word on to us. So he's talking about us here. "I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world." And then he says, "I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one." And then he pretty much repeats that again here when he says, "They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. As you have sent me into the world, I have also sent them into the world." So here's what Christ is saying here. He's saying, okay, you're not of the world, but it's in the world. You know, if you're not of it because you changed, but you have to live in this world. You have to make a living. You have to make decisions. You have to do all kinds of things just to exist in this world. So, is the Bible enough? In other words, let's use the extreme example. I wanted to be a structural engineer. If I had just prayed enough, would God have given me all the knowledge to become a structural engineer? Could I have done it through prayer? If my faith was strong enough, could I have just sat back, opened up my brain, God flooded it with all the knowledge that I needed? I don't think so. I don't see how that follows with God's teachings. You know, we have to do something. We have to educate ourselves in certain ways. We are in the world, so we have to live kind of by the rules of this world. And we have to make some judgments. And science is one way to help us make those judgments. Now, I want to talk about a parable that's found in Luke 16, but let me just take you through the first part of it before I turn to it. The parable of the unjust steward. The master had heard some rumors of mismanagement by this servant, and he called him in and told him to give an account, and the servant just panicked because he knew he had mismanaged things. And he knew he would never get another job if he was fired from this one. And so he goes out and he does damage control. And he goes to different people that owed his master money, and he makes deals. Say, look, you go ahead and pay off this amount. I'll give you a discount. And so he was giving discounts to get some money. And so he was wheeling and dealing. And his master saw it and appreciated it. That he was pretty smart to have done that. And let's pick up the story here in Luke 16, verse 8. And we'll read through verse 13. And so the master commended the unjust servant because he had dealt shrewdly. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. And what exactly is Christ saying here? You might say the moral of the parable. The sons of this world are pretty shrewd in the things of this world. You know, the business of this world. Even more shrewd than some of us converted Christians. Okay, so he's making this observation. There's some smart people out there. They know how to make a good living. They know how to accomplish things. In this world, much better than some of us do. And then he goes on and he says, I say to you, make friends for yourself by unrighteous mammon. Now, mammon is generally considered, well, sometimes it's translated as money, but it's, in a broader term, it's wealth, talking about physical wealth of various things. But it says, make friends for yourself by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, or in the margin it fails, they may receive you into an everlasting home. Now wealth can fail. You know, you could go bankrupt and wealth could fail and you may have to start over again. But wealth will always fail in the end because you're going to die. And what good is the wealth going to do you then? Oh, it may do your heirs some good, but it's not going to do you much good. Well, maybe they'll take a little bit of your wealth and buy a coffin or something, but, you know, the wealth is gone. And when it fails, it says, you know, make friends for yourself by unrighteous mammon. In other words, use it well. You know, understand how to use it. And he goes on to say here, who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much, and he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. And then he comes to the therefore. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in unrighteous mammon, who will commit to you, your trust, true riches. That sounds like what Christ is saying here is if you can't handle whatever wealth you're developing, accumulated, whatever, if you don't handle it well, how am I going to trust you in the kingdom? And he goes on, and if you have not been faithful in what is another man's, and there are a few of us who aren't working for another man. Most of us, you know, we work for somebody else. And if you've not been faithful in what's another man's, who will give you what is your own? And then he says, no servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. That almost sounds like a little bit of contradiction. First he says, be friends with it, and then says you can't serve it. Or if you serve God, you can. But notice what he's saying here. He didn't say, be friends with unrighteous mammon. He said, make friends for yourself by the use of unrighteous mammon. In other words, do good for other people is another way to look at it. You know, be fair in managing your affairs and managing the affairs of who you work for. In other words, be a good Christian is really what he's saying there. But if you decide that I want money and I'm going to work and I'm going to get it. I'm going to get money. I'm going to be a millionaire. I'm going to be the next somebody. Yeah, if that becomes your God, if that becomes such a goal that everything else is cast aside, that's what he's saying here. You can't serve God and mammon. Which, you know, the question is, well, why does he use the term unrighteous mammon here? Is he saying all wealth is unrighteous? Kinda. 1 Timothy 6, verse 10. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. So it's, wealth is a root of a lot of evil if it's misused. If you're not using the blessings that God has given you in the right way, then that's a big problem. So that's where the unrighteous comes from, because it's misused so much. You know, God doesn't tell us anywhere in the Bible that I've found, go out and see how rich you can get. Yeah, he doesn't tell us that. It'd be nice. I wish he said, one of your main goals is to go out and be as rich as you can and live the good life on this earth. But he doesn't tell us that. But he does tell us something else. In Proverbs 4, verses 5 through 9, he says, get wisdom, get understanding. Do not forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her, and she will preserve you. Love her, and she will keep you. Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And in all you're getting, while you're at it, get understanding. Exalt her, and she will promote you. She will bring you honor when you embrace her. She will place on your head an ornament of grace, a crown of glory she will deliver to you. All right, so there, God, pretty straightforward in many places. This is just one example of how that you need wisdom. You need to go after it. You need to pursue it. So what? How do we do that? Well, the primary source is the Bible. God makes that clear in his word. But a secondary source is the world. Now, there's a lot of wisdom that we have gotten from the world. I got all my wisdom of structural engineering from the world. None of it from the Bible. And you think about wisdom. Think about wisdom, the wisdom that we have now. So much is at our fingertips. You know, this little thing right here, I think I've got it off. Let me turn it on. This little thing right here, what would people centuries ago, give to have this thing. Yeah, more wisdom is at your fingertips here than a king with all the advisors of his whole nation from times past. It's all right here. Let's try it. Hey, Siri, what is mammon?
A famine is a widespread scarcity of food caused by several factors, including war, natural disasters, crop failure, population imbalance.
Oh, let's try that again. Sorry, Siri. Hey, Siri, what is mammon?
Mammon in the New Testament of the Bible is commonly thought to mean money, material wealth, or any entity that promises wealth and is associated with the greedy pursuit of gain. Should I keep going?
You know, it's tempting to just keep asking Siri questions and let her give the sermon, but I won't do that. But I better turn this off again. But the point is, yeah, to 30 or 40 years ago, you wouldn't know what mammon was. You had to go dig out a dictionary, encyclopedia, and all kinds of stuff to get information. And now you just ask Siri. You Google it. You know, so we have all this wisdom available at our fingertips. And of course, a lot of that wisdom is, well, kind of, you have to sort it all out, because some of it is, I love to use this popular word, fake wisdom. So, but now, look at Matthew 6 and verse 19 through 24. Do not lay up for yourselves treasure on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourself treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. You know, so here's the other place where Christ refers to mammon here. He says, for wherever your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The light of the lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters, for either he will love one and hate the other, or else he'll be loyal to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. So there it is again. So what do we do? How do we make good judgments? How do we avoid the pitfalls of good judgment? You know, there are two things that really get in the way of making good judgments. And I'm going to look at it from both the scientific viewpoint and from the Bible and see what we can learn from both. But the problems, basically, the main pitfalls of good judgment is bias and noise. Bias is a kind of a systematic deviation. Noise is just kind of a scatter. And let me show you what I mean by talking about a little target practice here. You know, if you take this target and you see take five shots at it, and I've shown you the X's of where the five shots landed, they're right there in the center of the target, pretty tight grouping. That individual is a good shot. Okay, so with them centered that tight, that is very little bias and very little noise. But now suppose the five shots look something like this. Now, they're still kind of centered around the middle of the target, but they're scattered out. That's an example of noise. This person was not that good a shot, and so his shots were kind of randomly scattered. But he was aiming at the target. It just wasn't that his heart was beating too fast or whatever. But then how about if the shots look like this? There's no noise there, but all the shots were to the left and below the center of the target. That's bias. That's bias when you're consistently off in one direction. And then there's bias and noise, where there's a scatter, but now this scatter is kind of shifted to the left a little bit. So you have bias and noise. So these are two different things. And I'm going to focus on on bias in this sermon, primarily. But let's talk about what worldly wisdom tells us. Making judgment from the scientific perspective. What can we learn from the world? Well, there are two types of judgments, first of all, talking about making judgments that influence your life. Judgments that can be deemed correct or not in the future. You know, if a doctor is diagnosing somebody, that judgment can be deemed correct when whatever it is progresses, and it turns out, yes, that was COVID, or no, it wasn't COVID. But, you know, it can be that generally certain predictions can be answered as either right or wrong by looking, seeing what happened in the future. But then there's judgments whose outcomes cannot be specifically measured. I suspect a lot of you have changed jobs at some point in your life. Was that decision a good decision? Did that really work out well? How do you know? I was teaching at Mississippi State, took a job at LSU, came down here. Now, it was a pretty good life down here. Met a lot of nice people. Nice church. But was that the best decision? Was my judgment right in doing that? See, I don't know what would have happened if I had stayed in Starkville and stayed at Mississippi State. Matter of fact, I had feelers from Ohio and Alabama about coming up to interview. I didn't go interview them. Would that have been, you know, who knows? How do you determine whether, yeah, that was the right judgment? That was the best judgment. You know, there's some things we really can't answer specifically. We can say, yeah, it seemed pretty good. Yeah, I made out all right. You know, but how do you know? Well, let's talk about some scientific studies, and there's been a lot. And I'm just going to summarize some of it. I've talked about some of this a little bit before. Studies on accuracy of the news pundits. You know, people on Face the Nation, Meet the Press, This Week. The pundits as a whole. And people, what they did is went back and looked at some of these things for years and looked at the predictions that were made and see which ones were true, came true, and which ones didn't. And basically the answer was they're no more accurate than flipping a coin. Now, some are a little bit better than 50%, some are a little bit lower. But on the average, you've gotten about the same information if you just flipped a coin. Not very accurate are these pundits. But in every study, and there's been a number of them, every study emphasized this one thing. Pundits showed a high confidence in their reasoning and predictions. They were sure that they were right. I mean, this high confidence was a characteristic of all of these. All right, now, let's look at summarize some studies on the accuracy of professionals. You know, I'm talking about judges, physicians, insurance adjusters, weather forecasters, or whatever. Now, a lot of these, let's take judges. There have been a lot of studies on judges' sentences. And, you know, somebody steals something, you know, what is the right sentence? You know, there is no right sentence. So what they did, they collection of 30, 40 judges, gave them the exact same trial histories. Person was convicted, and then they asked each of these 40 judges, what sentence would you give? And then they tallied them all up and said, okay, the average is probably pretty close to being right. You know, the collective wisdom of a lot of people tends to be, and studies have shown, tends to be pretty good. And so they used that as the right answer, and then they looked at this, how much people were wrong on either side of that. And then they did this, the same things with the insurance adjusters and Now, physicians, they could kind of see whether the diagnosis was correct or not by looking at what happened in the future. So some they had answers to. But so this, you know, in some cases it was unknown. They took the average value and compared it to all these multiple professionals and what they predicted. Now, as the numerous experimental studies have shown that judges, physicians, and other professionals showed significant disparities in judgment, there was a widespread. You might say this is the noise, and I'm going to talk about noise in the next sermon. But there was a lot of noise there. But I'll give you one example in the case of underwriters. You know, underwriters insuring businesses. The underwriter has to decide how much risk is it going to be to insure this business and come up with a dollar amount to charge them for the insurance. And so they did a study of underwriters. Now, the CEOs predicted a variance of about 10% from the average, and it was actually about 55%. There's a lot of scatter. You know, they gave the exact same conditions and asked, you know, 30 or 40 different insurance adjusters, you know, what would be the cost for a year of insurance under this condition. Yeah, the scatter was 55%. But the other thing, well, the conclusions basically were, again, professionals believe they are much better decision makers than the data indicates. In other words, they have a superiority bias. They think they know more in their professional opinion than anybody else. Now, this arrogance creates some problems in judgments, and that's why there's a lot of differences in the judgment of these experts in these different fields. And that they dismiss the factors that do not support their judgment. You know, just, well, that's not an important factor, and just dismiss it. Or they don't seriously consider other possible alternatives. They get focused in on one, dismiss anything that doesn't really support that. And meantime, don't even consider some other alternatives in that situation. You know, so the problem, a big problem, is the bias of superiority, which we use the term pride, and inordinate self-esteem over an act or possession, or arrogance, which is pride on steroids, an attitude of superiority that shows itself in an overbearing manner or in presumptive claims or assumptions. Now, so the question, you've dealt with, the main professionals you've probably dealt with are doctors. Now, surely you've never seen an arrogant doctor, have you? No offense against any doctors in the crowd. But you know what? This showed out, and this affects the decisions. You know, this self-confidence, this pride, this arrogance was the big thing in affecting the decisions that professionals make in judgments. Now, what does the Bible say? Now, judgments from the Bible perspective. Well, let's just hit a few of the highlights here. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 21 is first thing. Test and evaluate data prior to making a judgment. And that's what 1 Thessalonians 5:21 says. Test all things, hold fast that which is good. You've got to look at the data and test it. Second point is, do not neglect the spirit in man nor God's spirit. 1 Corinthians 2:11. For what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of man which is in him? Even so, no one knows the things of God except the spirit of God. So there's two sources of knowledge. There's man's wisdom. God's given us a spirit, a physical spirit, to understand that he hadn't given to anything else that he created, just to humankind. And so there's that you might say, the ability to get worldly knowledge. But then there's this ability to get spiritual knowledge. And that's the shortcoming of science. They're trying to do it all based on worldly knowledge. Third is renew the spirit of God by examining your faith. Psalm 51:10. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. And this is David's prayer after his sin with Bathsheba. He made a pretty bad judgment there. But he comes to God and asks to be purified, to be clean, to be forgiven. That's not very sciencey. But that's what God says. You want to improve your judgments. When you mess up, you come to God and talk to him about it and learn from that. And another scripture, 2 Corinthians 13:5. Examine yourself as to whether you're in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you unless you indeed are disqualified, as the margin says, or fail the test? But God said, well, look at what you're doing after you've done it and learn from it. And always remember, there's an element of faith. And if you're not in the faith, in other words, if you're not obeying God, that's really what we're talking about. Faith is, well, obeying God. If you're not doing that, yeah, you're going to make some pretty bad decisions. And then number four, judge yourself by looking at past results. For if we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. But when we are judged, we are chastened by the Lord, that we may not be condemned with the world. That's 1 Corinthians 11, verses 31 and 32. But you see, you're gonna make some misjudgments, and God doesn't like it, and so He's gonna get your attention. You know, He could just whack you upside the head with a 2x4, but He does it more subtly than that. But He's sending you messages. You know, so He wants you to look at your past mistakes and learn from them and repent of them. Fifth is ask God to guide you in making judgments. Psalm 26, verses 1 and 2. Vindicate me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity. I've also trusted in the Lord. I shall not slip. Examine me, O Lord, and prove me. Try my mind and my heart. And so here David is saying, I'm following your laws. I'm faithful. Test me to make sure. You ever ask God to do that? You ever kind of say, you know, God, things have been going along too easy. I haven't had any trials. I haven't had any problems. Everything is so great. I think you need to test me a little bit more. I think you're letting me off too easy. Have you ever said that prayer? I haven't either. But that's what David is basically saying here. Now, David wasn't let off that easy on many occasions, but that was his attitude. And then the sixth point on judgment from the Bible perspective, or from God's perspective, you may be able to fool men in your judgments, but not God. Hebrews 4, verse 12. For the word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even the division of the soul and the spirit and of the joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and the intents of the heart. God can read our mind. I don't even like to think about that, because that's kind of scary sometimes, especially when you're not in the right place with God. All right, so that's the overall view. But now here's a question. Well, you know, what about pride and arrogance? And that's what the science says. Biggest bias is the superiority bias. Pride, which results from pride and arrogance. What does pride and arrogance do? Well, it causes failure. Proverbs 26:12. Do you see a man wise in his own eyes? There's more hope for a fool than for him. Yeah, you're going to fail. It leads to destruction, Proverbs 16:18. Pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. It places the self over God. Now, these first two, science kind of tells us this. Those first two agrees with science here. Yeah, pride and arrogance, they're bad. And it gets you in trouble. But this third thing places yourself over God. The wicked, in his proud countenance, does not seek God. God is in none of his thoughts. See, there we're outside the realm of science now. Or four, puts your eternal life in jeopardy. 1 Corinthians 10:12. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. That's talking about immediate problems of being failing in what you had thought was a wise decision. But long term, it means, falling away from God. And then number five, it violates the first and the great commandment. Exodus 20, verse 3, first of the Ten Commandments, you shall not have no other gods before you. You're putting yourself before God when you have pride and arrogance. And then Matthew 22, verses 37 and 38, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And, this is the big thing here. And, from a scientific viewpoint, pride and arrogance, it just makes you make poor decisions because you're not looking at all the data, you're not doing this. But, the big problem, science can't get hold of that. You're putting yourself, you're elevating yourself above God. And that brings me to a question, related to this. Why does God hate pride and arrogance so much? You ever thought about that? God seems to hate, just read through the Bible, God seems to hate pride and arrogance more than he hates murder, more than he hates lying, more than he likes stealing. He just seems to hate pride and arrogance, just so much emphasis on it. He just hates it. Why? Isaiah 13, verse 11. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will halt the arrogance of the proud and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. He's talking about the day of the Lord. I'm going to crush you. Why? Because your pride and your arrogance. Proverbs 8:13. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Pride and arrogance, the evil way, and the perverse mouth I hate. God doesn't say, I looked, I said, how many times did God say he hates anything? Six times. Here's one of them. That he hates, and he hates pride and arrogance. Daniel 5:20, referring to Nebuchadnezzar. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was disposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. So, hardened heart due to pride. That was Nebuchadnezzar's problem, his pride. Pharaoh's problem was his pride, and his heart was hardened. Proverbs 6:16-19. These six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. These are the seven deadly sins. How do they start? A proud look. That's where they start. A lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift to running to evil, a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among the brethren. So there it is again. But that's not all. What was the cause of Satan's rebellion? Isaiah 14, verses 13 through 15. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the further sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit." God really hates arrogance and pride. You know, it's one of the 13 evil things that defile a person. In Mark 7, verse 21 through 23, Christ lists, "For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness." All these evil things come from within and defile a man. And then, 1 John 2:16, "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world." God hates pride and arrogance. Why? You know, a lot of sins that he didn't come down nearly as hard as he does some pride and arrogance. Because you're putting yourself above God. That's the answer. Pride and arrogance, you're putting yourself above God. You think you know more than God. You ever thought, "Hey, this is a simple judgment. Don't worry, God, I've got this." You ever got that thought? Didn't bother to pray about it much because, the answer's obvious. And then you find out, the answer wasn't really that obvious. I'll give you one example in closing here. Uzziah. It's in 2 Chronicles 26. I want to start in verses 3 and 4 here. Uzziah was 16 years old when he became king, and he reigned 52 years in Jerusalem. And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. This is one of the good guys, one of the good kings. 52 years, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. Now, he began his reign pretty young, 16 years old. And if you read through the whole passage, I'm just going to read a few key verses here. If you read through the whole passage, you'll see that he had some godly advisors. He had some people that were guiding him, and they were guiding him in God's way. And if we drop down to verses 15 and 16 of 2 Chronicles 26, "So his fame spread far and wide, for he was marvelously helped till he became strong." He was marvelously helped by God until he became strong. And how did God help him? Judah was down in the dumps. There were enemies all around, and they were stronger than Judah. And he built up Judah. He made Judah strong. He made Uzziah come up with all kinds of weapons and armaments and soldiers. And he just conquered everybody around him. And his fame became known far and wide. Because he did what was right in the sight of God. But when he was strong, his heart was lifted up unto his destruction, for he transgressed against the Lord, his God, by entering the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. He had it made. He was victorious in all his wars. Nobody was going to threaten him now. He was strong, and they were scared. And he decides to do the job of the high priest. Go into the temple and make a sacrifice. What kind of dumb thinking? We talk about dumb decisions. It's kind of fun to look in the Bible and say, "Man, that was so dumb." But then you start thinking of your own life and say, "Yeah, I made some pretty dumb decisions too." You know, it's so easy to talk about other people's dumb decisions. Kind of hard to even recognize our own dumb decisions in many cases. But you know, the high priest and the other priests confronted him, said, "You can't do this." And he said, "Oh, yes, I can." And immediately leprosy broke out on his face. And so then, dropping down to verse 21 of 2 Chronicles 26, King Uzziah was a leper until the day of his death. He dwelt in an isolated house because he was a leper, for he was cut off from the house of the Lord. Then Jotham, his son, was over the king's house, judging the people of the land. Now, if you look at the lineage of the kings of Israel and Judah, this is a case where there was some overlap, because his son took over and he was still alive, and so you look at the reigns and so forth. But some people have gone through and tried to figure this out, and what they believe is it was somewhere around 12 to 14 years, that the last 12 to 14 years of Uzziah's reign, that he was a leper. So most of his life, he was king, he was successful, and then he got this dumb idea. Can you describe it as anything but arrogance? The superiority bias? And after all the blessings, he ended up with leprosy for the last 12 years or so of his life. And he died from it. Now, look at Luke 12, verse 48. For everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required. And to whom much has been committed, of him they will ask the more. And I think sometimes we kind of forget this part. The more we're given, the more we're expected in the way we live and the way we behave. He was given a lot, and he was expected. A lot was expected of him. He failed that test. We're given a lot in a different way from Uzziah, but we're given a lot. Yeah, so both science and the Bible agree that the bias of that leads to arrogance is a dagger in the heart of a good judgment. Let's summarize why. Yeah. Well, being imperfect does not mean that all worldly wisdom is bad. Just because the world's imperfect doesn't mean all the worldly wisdom is bad. Worldly wisdom verified by a multitude of supporting data and used within that context can be an asset to improving judgments. So there's room for science, good science. But number three, neglecting God's wisdom, which is perfect, while accepting the wisdom of the world, which is in person, now, that can be a big problem if you don't sort that out. Number four, God warns us of how deadly arrogance can be. It is deadly. He hates it. I mean, he really hates it. He really, really, really hates it. You know, the scriptures I read just kind of jump out and slap you in the face. Number five, arrogance can lead to dismissing factors that do not support your judgment. That's what science has told us. Arrogance can lead to not even considering viable alternatives when you make a judgment, a decision. And then the bias of superiority is a huge bias. When it comes to making judgment, it leads you to elevating yourself before God. That's the big one. That's the big one. And so I focused on that in this sermon. Next sermon, I want to talk some more about judgment. I'll talk about some of the other biases that may affect. And I want to get into this whole business of noise. What about noise? So we'll do that next time.